Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
Logically, a foreigner who did not see these days at first hand would probably imagine, at a time when an egg cost as much as the price of a luxury car in the past, women would be rushing through the streets tearing their hair, shops would be empty because no one could afford to buy anything, and the theaters and other places of entertainment would have no audiences at all. Astonishingly, however, it was just the opposite. The will for life to go on proved stronger than the instability of the currency. In the midst of financial chaos, daily life continued almost unchanged. Individuals, of course, felt a great deal of change. The rich were impoverished when their money in banks and government securities melted away. Spectators grew rich. But regardless of individual fates, the flywheel of the mechanism kept on turning in the same old rhythm. Nothing stood still. The baker made bread, the cobbler made boots, the writer wrote books, the farmer cultivated the land, trains ran regularly, and the places of entertainment in particular, the bars and theaters, were full to overflowing. For with the daily loss in value of money, once the most stable aspect of life, people came to appreciate true values, such as work, love, friendship, art, and nature, all the more. And in the midst of disaster, the nation as a whole lived more intensely than ever before, strung to a higher pitch. Young men and girls went walking in the mountains and came home tanned brown by the sun. Music played in the dance halls until late at night. New factories and businesses were founded everywhere. I myself do not think I ever lived and worked with more intensity and concentration than I did in those years. What had been important to us before mattered all the more now. Art was never more popular than at the time of chaos. Money had let us down. We sensed that what was eternal in us was all that would last. I will never forget what operatic performances were like in those days of our greatest need. You groped your way through dimly lit streets, for street lighting was feeling the effects of the fuel shortage. You paid for your seat in the gallery with a bundle of banknotes that would once have allowed you to hire a luxurious box for a year. You sat in your overcoat because the auditorium was unheated and pressed close to your neighbors for warmth. And the theater itself, once brilliant with uniforms and expensive gowns, was so dismal and gray. No one knew whether it would still be possible for the opera to keep going next week if money went on falling in value and there were no coal deliveries. Everything seemed doubly desperate in this scene of former luxury and imperial extravagance. The musicians of the Philharmonic sat in the pit, also gray shadows of themselves, emaciated and exhausted by deprivation, and we in the audience looked like ghosts in this now ghostly theater. But then the conductor raised his baton, the curtains parted, and it was more wonderful than ever before. The singers and musicians gave of their best, for they all felt that this might be the last time they performed in the theater they loved. And we listened with bated breath, more receptive than ever, knowing that for us, too, this might be the last time. Thousands of us, hundreds of thousands, lived like this. We all strained ourselves to the limit in these weeks and months and years on the brink of downfall. I never felt the will to live in a nation and in myself as strongly as I did then, when the end of everything, life and survival itself, was at stake. The quote is describing Vienna, not Prague, and I've taken its references to any German-speaking territory out, because the conditions could describe anywhere in Europe during and between the wars. It's from The World of Yesterday by Stefan Zweig, his memoir of what it meant to be an exile from a fragile kingdom of culture that ceased to exist with Hitler because Hitler wanted to make a version of it permanent. Like so many rich German Jews, Zweig found himself a bit chased by Hitler, first to London, but when the Blitz came to England, Zweig wrongly sensed that a free England's days were numbered. So he crossed the Atlantic Ocean to New York, where he found something arguably worse than the Nazis, vulgarity, and left for Brazil. Zweig, a Jew and lifelong socialist and pacifist, thought himself as much a citizen of the world as an Austrian, but whatever world he belonged to had revoked his citizenship. He was, in his own words, miles and miles away from all that was formerly my life, books, concerts, friends, and conversation. And in the Brazilian town of Petropolis, he and his wife took an overdose of barbiturates. When they were found, they were holding hands. This concert was on the 5th of June, 1939. The Germans, double-crossing Hitler's promise to Neville Chamberlain, captured Czechoslovakia on March 15th of the same year. Every movement of Mavlast 6 was followed by a thunderous ovation that can be heard over the radio air check. What we cannot hear is the spontaneous eruption of the Czech national anthem which followed the performance, a real-life equivalent to the Marseillaise scene in Casablanca. This was music making so powerful that the Nazis banned the piece from performance in occupied Czechoslovakia until the Czech Philharmonic, with their nearly forgotten founding music director, Václav Talík, forced the issue by playing the work in Berlin and creating a sensation there. Afterwards, Smetana's Mavlast was allowed to be performed again in occupied Czechoslovakia. But just the next year, the Nazis dismissed Václav Talík from his post and closed most of Prague's important cultural institutions. In orchestral music, as in every kind of music, there are some concerts that go into legend. Most of these concerts have been recorded, and the legend is sometimes more important than the performance itself. At this point in history, the most legendary conductor of all is probably Wilhelm Furtwängler. His most famous performance is Beethoven's Ninth in 1942. Some music lovers, not me, think it's an unparalleled event in musical performance, and a large part of the aura surrounding that recording is a disproven rumor that Hitler was in the audience. His performance of the same piece in 1951 is similarly legendary for a lot of people because it commemorated the post-war resurrection of the Bayreuth Festival, which Wagner meant to promote his own music, and Hitler used for all manner of propaganda. When Bayreuth came back, it was as though German culture itself came back. Furtwängler's Beethoven 9 from 1954 is legendary because he apparently decided during that performance that he no longer wanted to live, and died 3 months later. A certain kind of classical music lover will always say that they hear Furtwängler's agony in the 42 performance, or a kind of awed solemnity in 51, or his serenity in the 54 performance. Classical music obsessives were always a strange breed of people, but given how against the current you have to swim to love this music in 2018, you have to be still weirder to love this music now. A few, perhaps, will say the same about Bernstein's excruciatingly slow Beethoven's Ninth in 89 Berlin after the fall of the wall on Christmas Eve, or his Shostakovich Five from 1959 at the height of the Cold War when he took the New York Philharmonic to play it in Moscow, where Shostakovich loved the performance so much that he hugged Bernstein on stage. Such legends have grown around Bruno Walter's performance of Beethoven's Fidelio at the Metropolitan Opera after braving the U-boats to come to America in 1941, or his Mahler 9 in 38 Vienna, 2 weeks before the Anschluss, or Willem Mengelberg's performance of the St. Matthew Passion by Bach at the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam the year before the Nazi invasion of Holland, or Karl Schuricht conducting Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde in 39 Amsterdam, when at a quiet moment some lady shouts, "Deutschland über alles, Herr Schuricht!" Or Furtwängler's Bruckner 5 in 1942 Berlin, when you can supposedly hear bombs going off in the distance. That recording is one of my favorite recordings of anything, but I've never heard even a dull thud. Whether or not these performances are worthy of the reputations, there is an aura that seems to have grown around them, because at crucial moments of life and death, music simply seems to mean more. And whether the performances are objectively better, many of them certainly are riskier. More extreme tempos, rawer sounds, or at least that's what it seems like through the compressed sonics. Whether or not these performances deserve their reputations, they are larger-than-life statements of music-making from an era when life was so large because it was suffused with death. Except for Beethoven 9, Smetana's Mavlast is almost unique in that it has at least three such legendary performances, and they're all somewhat, at least, worthy of their reputation. And we'll talk a lot more about that third, more famous performance later. So now, a few minutes on Wagner from a very perceptive, though eccentric, music writer, David P. Goldman.
A unique feature of the Western tonal system is what's called the leading tone. That's the seventh scale stepper C. It's that C do, which distinguishes Western music and creates a form of closure. It's usually accompanied by the fifth scale step in the bass. And there's practically no piece of music, Western music, that you can think of which doesn't have that form of resolution to the leading tone. The leading tone has a directionality. The half step, the small interval, which leads up to the tonic, gives us that sense of closure. And composers discovered that if you reverse what you might call the natural direction of the leading tone, it creates an interesting effect. So think of a song like Puff the Magic Dragon. Instead of having, we have the tonic falling to the leading tone, the eighth step going to the scale step, do going to C. And the harmony in the bass, as it were, weights that down. So instead of moving upwards towards the expected goal, we're moving away from it. Somewhere over the rainbow. Or both sides out. And so forth. In popular music, also in classical music, the sense of the leading tone moving in the wrong direction has a symbolic meaning which is rooted in musical function. The first example I can think of is a Schubert song called Im Frühling, in the spring. You have the same falling leading tone. About a guy who lost a girl, and all of these examples, and the many others you can find in the literature, have one thing in common. They all evoke nostalgia. In other words, if you want to put it too simply, instead of going home, we're going away from home. Takes this principle, this musical device, and does something exceptionally clever with it. The climactic moment in Siegfried, the moment for which Wagner said the whole world was created, so that two such beings as Siegfried and Brunhilde could meet each other, occurs in the third act of Siegfried. And as Siegfried has climbed through the magic fire and clambered up the mountain where Brunhilde lies in a magic sleep, he cuts off her armor, and there she is revealed as a woman, and he kisses her, and that kiss occurs on this big B major seventh chord. Tells us it resolves fortissimo here. And this is a fairly conventional resolution. I try to imagine this is the brass. Fortissimo. And you kind of stay in that chord as long as the brass players can, and as their faces turn red, that great fortissimo turns to a pianissimo here. With six harps doing the arpeggios. So again, Siegfried gets up the mountain, kisses Brunhilde, and it appears to resolve on from B major to E minor, normal 5-1 resolution, except it turns out that what we thought was the fifth of E minor is really the leading tone of C major. Now, there wasn't a hint of C major before, but Brunhilde is going to awaken. She says, "Heil dir, Solna! Hail to you, son! This is the climactic, decisive moment of the ring cycle, And it's actually a very clever device, worthy of Siegfried and Roy, because Wagner makes us think we're in one place, and then we wake up, as it were, and we're in another. Retrospectively, with no advance warning, we interpret what seemed to be an E minor tonic chord to simply be passing motion up to the C. And that very neatly evokes, in purely musical terms, the idea of moving from one state to another. And that's what Brunhilde is doing in a double sense. She is, of course, waking up. So she was asleep and now she's awake. And when you wake up, you reinterpret from the standpoint of being awake whatever you might have dreamed of when you were asleep.
We never do hear what Goldman says is the second state, but I think we can interpolate that it is a transfigurative awakening, an awakening of human beings to be something different than what they were before. Now, here is Smetana's motif. Siegfried, the opera from which this excerpt comes, premiered in 1876. Mavlost was begun in 1874. The score for Siegfried was finished 5 years earlier in 1871, so it's conceivable, albeit doubtful, that Smetana had played through the score on his own time. But unless Smetana had the score, and I would imagine it was difficult to come by, and more informed musicologists than I would know better, it stands as an uncanny coincidence that both Wagner and Smetana were creating their own forms of musical nationalism at the exact same historical moment, using almost completely reciprocal musical chord progressions from each other. So here is Wagner. And here now is Smetana's motif. Not exactly the same chords, but very nearly, and in backwards order. Now, Wagner's chords free float in a river of chromaticism without any solid ground on which to stand. By going away from home, he thinks that we can find a new home. Now, there is plenty of harmonic chromaticism and dissonance in Mavlost, but Smetana's chords fundamentally stand firmly on the solid ground of tonal harmony. Smetana is trying to evoke coming home. But Wagner was the great influence upon every composer of his time, either in imitation or in rebellion. Smetana, like so many composers of his generation, owed Wagner everything. Here is Wagner's evocation of Germany's Rhine River in full flow in Das Rheingold, which King Ludwig of Bavaria forced Wagner to premiere in advance of the entire Ring cycle's completion, and which the music world must have known intimately in piano reduction afterwards. And here now is Smetana's evocation of Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic at this point's Vltava River, in full flow in the middle of the Moldau. Copyright didn't exist yet. Personally, I think Smetana must have seen the score not only to Das Rheingold, but also to Siegfried, however difficult it might have been to come by. Here are the two violin sections alone at the top of their register, at the end of Brünnhilde's awakening, when it becomes complete and she hails the sun. And now here's the moment in the Moldau when the Vltava River goes so far beyond our line of vision that it disappears. So if Smetana didn't see the score, then the parallels are that much more uncanny. It's one of those cosmic coincidences that history sometimes presents us with, in which two creators climb their way through opposite sides of the same mountain and meet at the summit. Now, it's fruitless to imagine the difference between these two nationalisms by the way the composers use harmony, but there's clearly a difference in the use of their musical materials and their musical aims. Wagner's harmonic use was expansive. He was trying to create something extra musical in the midst of the richest musical tradition of his time and perhaps of all time. It's a world populated by gods and dwarves and soul states and transfigurations. Whether or not Wagner meant it that way, it was music that quickly became catnip to intellectuals in a country who wanted to show the world that they were not only a great nation, but a better nation than others. Smetana wanted his music merely to get the Czechs a small space at the table of great music. Smetana was perhaps set on his determined path to be a great Czech composer by overhearing the great Austrian conductor Johann Herbeck, the first great champion of Bruckner, complain that for all the world's great Czech musicians, they produced no great composers. So to show that Smetana's music and Czech music itself was ready to be thought as great as any other, Smetana deliberately channeled not only Wagner, but the giant of giants, Beethoven himself. Here is the beginning of the famous theme from Beethoven's Ninth. And here it is in completely disguised form as a polka-like dance in the first movement of Mavlast. By the late 19th century, Beethoven's music probably became seen as a lot more pompous than Beethoven meant it to be. But it's as though Smetana is presenting a conception of music, a Czech conception of music, completely foreign to Wagner-era Germany. This conception is more earthy and physical, it's more rooted in the dance, it's more deliberately raucous, and it's far less concerned with the state of the soul. It's a music for direct application and instant communication, and a music that can not only be loved by the educated connoisseur, but elevate peasants to the connoisseur's level. And it's a music that, at least in that sense, takes up Beethoven's mantle far more than Wagner ever wished to. And it was Beethoven who provided Smetana with the most important way forward of all in the great crisis of Smetana's life, the crisis that would kill him 10 years later. Nobody quite knows why Beethoven went deaf. The cause is sometimes attributed to an autoimmune disorder like lupus or perhaps to typhus, and some quacks even think it was Beethoven's habit of dousing his head in cold water to wake himself up. But in Smetana's case, he woke up at the age of 50 to find himself deaf in one ear, and woke up 3 weeks later to find himself deaf in the other. The cause was simple and as 19th century as causes come: syphilis. Within 8 years, Smetana would experience hallucinations and sometimes lose his power of speech, and within 9, he would be a violent threat to those around him. In 1884, one of the greatest and most eminent artists in the world would die in Prague's Katernky asylum for lunatics. The crowd for his funeral was in the thousands, who all lined up to pay tribute to the artist who gave them voice. So you hear automatically from the very beginning the harmonies that seem like coming home, the leading tone to the tonic. And beginning a 75-minute orchestral work with a harp solo, right away we know that this is a different kind of orchestra than was ever used before. Not even Wagner or Berlioz would begin an orchestral work with a harp solo. Now, this particular harp solo is supposed to represent the legendary bard of Czech mythology, Lumír. So already by referencing mythology, we see the same nostalgia about which David Goldman talked. Perhaps Lumír is strumming a medieval lute. So what tale exactly is Lumír telling us? Well, Vyšehrad is the ancestral seat of Czech memory and its earliest glory, which, like so many small European nations, goes back far into the first millennium. It's the primal longing and nostalgia of the Czech historical narrative. The title of this movement is Vyšehrad. Vyšehrad is the site of the long since destroyed castle of the earliest Bohemian kings, two of whom also became Holy Roman emperors. Now, to this day, small churches exist on the site that were built between the 8th and 11th centuries by the Přemyslid dynasty. Vyšehrad was the original settlement of Prague, and to this day it's customary for many Czechs to celebrate the new year by going to the sites. But Smetana is telling us a tale. The first two treble notes of the work are B-flat and E-flat, or in German notation, B and S, the initials of Bedřich Smetana. It's an official declaration, a defiance. Smetana will go on. It was only at 50 years old, when Smetana went deaf, that he began to compose full-time. Until he was 50, he was head of the Prague Provisional Opera and wrote a steady diet of music journalism. It was only when Smetana went deaf, neither able to conduct nor to review performing musicians, and forced by the manager of his company to sell the royalties of the opera season he'd already written to the company in exchange for an extremely meager annual stipend, that he was forced into composition full-time. Within 3 months of his deafness, he had written both Vyšehrad and the most famous of all his works, The Moldau. It was a Beethovenian feat, and he'd fully earned the right to appropriate Beethoven's music, as he did earlier, for his own purposes. But like so many composers, Beethoven was the giant from whose shadow he could no more free himself than the average Czech could from the Austrian Empire. One Bohemian king, Charles IV, became the Holy Roman Emperor, and while his successor, Wenceslas IV, was never named Holy Roman Emperor, he was elected to the title many Central European kings received before they became Holy Roman Emperor, King of the Romans, which actually meant King of the Germans, don't ask. But after just one Holy Roman Emperor and one King of the Romans, the Bohemian claim to the throne of Central Europe was supplanted by the Habsburgs of Austria, and thereafter the Bohemians and the Moravians, whom together make the Czechs, became subject to Austrian dominion for 500 years. The moment after Smetana quotes Beethoven's Ninth with its message of universal brotherhood, there is a long and noisy chromatic descent into the low notes of the orchestra that's supposed to symbolize the fall of Vyšehrad Castle. For the Czechs, universal brotherhood was a nice idea until it made them tyrannized but for an endless series of generations. Both nationalism and internationalism are based on questions of identity and social justice. Polar opposites, because they're polar opposites and therefore based on determining answers to the same questions, have more in common than any concept that might seem similar to them. Nationalism may seem like a poisonous disaster to us, but it seemed as much the answer to questions of how to redress social injustice in the 19th century to tens or hundreds of millions of people as internationalism or transnationalism or intersectionality seem in our day. They're all based on the idea that people should be able to live free and proudly within their identities. There's no denying the truth of that statement, but will internationalism in any of its various forms do any better than nationalism when people come to the realization that they may have to take up the cause of redressing injustice by force? And more importantly, does it matter? Humans will always dream of better days and better things. It's what keeps us alive from day to day, and their hopes and dreams of a better world are what enable them to build better worlds. Just as the dreams of greater equality through diversity inspire us today, dreams of greater equality through monoculture inspired people 150 years ago. In either case, it's the hope that sustains us and allows us to ever so slowly move forward step by halting step into a world where problems can be solved. Now, when you go to Visegrad, as I did 15 years ago, you see the peaceful landscape and you immediately see how and why it means so much to so many, no less than the Grand Canyon or the Statue of Liberty might to an American. And you might feel some small measure of peace knowing that millions of people have come here for so many hundreds of years to feed their yearnings and hope for better days. And that is the sentiment on which Smetana seems to end Visegrad.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?